Hello and welcome to the Green Room at Furnitubes. I'm your host, Catherine Barrett, and we're here every month with a new episode. Join us for industry musings, interviews, and discussions exploring all things landscape architecture, street furniture, and urban design. Hi, I'm joined today by the founders of the Humanitarian Landscape Collective, Rhys Jones, landscape architect at Alexandra Steed Urban, and Johanna Ferro, landscape architect at Arup. And the mission of the Human Landscape Collective is to bridge the gap between humanitarian work and landscape architecture. The collective aims to drive change by highlighting the crucial role landscape architecture can play in helping the most vulnerable communities. And HLC does this by bringing like-minded people together in thought leadership and research that can be shared and implemented. And I'm really pleased that you've both come in today. Thank you for coming in. Thanks for having
us. Thanks for having us.
So introduce yourselves and give us a brief overview of what you do and how your backgrounds have led you to come together to create HLC.
Yeah, so for me, it started in 2017 when I was doing my undergrad and I thought I wanted to look at how landscape architects could play a humanitarian role because I'd been away and kind of during my studies kind of felt like the stuff we were learning could be better suited to places, you know, that you might not think really need it. So I kind of wanted to dig into that. So I did that for undergrad dissertation, then wanted to test the theory on the ground. So then went away to Nicaragua the following summer to volunteer on a WASH project. And that wasn't like, it wasn't part of the course or anything, but I just found a way to go. And then whilst I was there, thought there might be a way to kind of tie in what I'd learned more. So then I just figured out what kind of like some of the landscape related issues were in the community, sort of found there was an issue with flooding and then tried to figure out a way of working with them to come up with a solution. And that went quite well. So came back, did a couple of talks on it, and there were some other people who were interested in the same thing as well. So we kind of realized there was a bit of a gap in that there was a lot of us doing this kind of work on like one-off initiatives. Like I'd done this paper and been away, someone else had done a project, someone else had done some research, but there's nothing tying us all together like getting architecture and engineering. So we thought it'd be good to just band together and figure out a way in which we could make a strategy for the profession as a whole. So that kind of like developed. So it kind of started as just a bit of a group and then we decided to look at something in particular, like a particular research topic. And then we formalized, we were going to team up with the LI, but decided not to. And then it's kind of around the time that Joe joined us as well.
I come at it from a different angle, and I'm really flattered that Rhys calls me his co-founder because he really was the pioneer of HLC because it really stemmed from his thesis and his experience in Nicaragua, where I came from it from a different angle in the sense that I was living in Africa my whole life. I was born and bred there, second generation Portuguese, and I went into architecture because there really wasn't, I hadn't even known that landscape architecture was even a profession.
Right.
So naturally I would have gone into it and I stumbled on it accidentally,
yep.
I could say. And I think it was that I was fortunate enough to get hired straight after university. I did my master's at the University of Johannesburg,
yep.
in architecture. And then I joined Arup in Johannesburg as an urban designer. Economically, the country was really struggling,
yep.
after the FIFA World Cup in 2010.
Yep.
And there was a lot of redundancies being made around in the office. So I thought, next thing, I have to jump on board, leave the country. There was no point of actually finding work. And there wouldn't even be work back home in Mozambique.
Yep.
You know, there's yep. literally no investment.
So does landscape architecture as a profession exist in, say, Mozambique?
In Mozambique, no.
But South Africa, yes.
Yes. Yeah. But very, like, underground. It's,
yeah.
it's definitely surfacing now.
Mm-hmm.
But when I graduated in 2015 and when I started my architectural career, there was just nothing.
Yeah.
I mean, I met someone who did landscape architecture, but they were just doing small-scale garden design.
Yep.
So nothing at a city scale, which I like working at.
Yep.
So I applied for a job at Arup in the UK, here in London, and thought to myself, I don't even know what I'm getting myself into. I thought I was a fraud. I was joining them. I was like, I don't know the first thing. I mean, I know I have an appreciation for nature because I grew up in nature, you know, descendants of farmers, like we're very connected to climate and environment, all the fluctuations. So I think it was just a natural gravitation towards landscape architecture. And the irony is that I'm doing landscape architecture in London, which is a very built up big city. But I do have the opportunities to work abroad in different contexts, like Bhutan and other places in the Middle East, even in Africa. So the idea was always to come here to go back with the skills. So going back to HLC, I started exploring disaster relief and recovery, life cycles, because we were in Mozambique, we hit with cyclones that are increasing in frequency and severity every year. We used to get them every 10 years. Now we get them almost twice a year.
Wow. And that's in your lifetime.
And that's in my lifetime. Yeah. And that's category 5, so the highest it can go. So I've always been very conscious about how livelihoods are uprooted and how to build back cities. And my background in architecture, which was at the University of Johannesburg, was very much focused in informal settlements and social architecture. I learned a lot of my skills and my interests were from those initial experiences. So I was trying to get back into that. And I found that there was just nothing at Arup that was really, I mean, there were people, engineers working in these spaces, but landscape architecture was just a void. And then I got connected with Rhys through a friend of ours, Ellie Earl, and she's a water engineer.
Wow. And so tell us a bit about the HLC initiative and what's its purpose and its values.
The long way of putting it is that we're a multidisciplinary research network. And the idea is to get landscape architects more engaged in building resilience in the world's most vulnerable communities, which is kind of like a long way of saying that, like, we feel like we have kind of the training and the skills and the knowledge to
help.
But like there's no kind of method or like way of actually doing it. There's kind of like an obvious like missing link or like a kind of a gap that needs to be bridged. And we kind of feel like the only way to really figure out how to do that is by teaming up with people who are already doing that kind of work or living within those affected contexts, and just bringing together all the kind of bits of like work and research and thinking that's gone into this kind of humanitarian role for us. So we kind of, you know, the detailed like mission and vision came about through a lot of conversations. So we felt like we should make sure we understand what our value and role could be in such places. And that has to come through educating both ourselves and the profession, which all starts with engaging with those other disciplines or affected people as well. And that kind of helps us build up like a two-way knowledge exchange as well. And then once you've got all that knowledge and understanding, you've got to advocate both to these other disciplines and sectors and then both to our own profession as well. Because, like, you know, I feel like people have this kind of like feeling that they want to get involved with this kind of work but don't really know how, or might not see there's like an actual potential role does exist out there. It's just making that link, which is what we want to do for people.
So one of the three sort of ethos really is to educate, to engage and recognize the work that already exists in the space.
So highlighting and bringing to the fore, I guess.
So there's nature-based solutions that are being applicable in humanitarian sectors and in the development sector. But we want to highlight that. So we do have a resource library on our website. So we're creating case studies that link nature-based solutions, which landscape architects obviously predominantly work in, but not everyone is a landscape architect. So we're advocating more the principles, but we are trying to mobilize landscape architects into the space as well. So we're not the knowledge custodians, because people on the ground as well have their knowledge of their climates, of their situations, of their, you know, shared history, and working with the climate themselves, coming up with their own solutions. So how do we exchange and share and have a different role?
And does that mean then that, so it's not just landscape architects who are involved? You've mentioned engineers. What other professions are involved in the collective in HLC?
Built environment professionals, But we also have charities, NGOs, people working on the ground. We even have people that have links to humanitarian law, people that are creating guidance on humanitarian, you know, standards.
Academics
as well, students. Yes, it's a wide range.
Anyone who's interested, basically.
Yeah.
But I guess like the kind of level we're trying to focus at with our work is more like the practitioner level, but we're trying to like combine, in doing that, you have to combine like policy, research, academia into stuff that needs to be built. So it's kind of our natural playing field. You kind of want to stay there and then combine all these things, which is why I want
the enablers of this work.
Right. And that, so you, it's like a hub of information and knowledge sharing, I guess, for people to put into and take out. Yeah. So how does this movement relate to humanitarian causes? How does it, what does it do? How is it, how would you say it helps?
There's a difference. So we found there's a difference between humanitarian and development work.
Right.
So even though we take on the name Humanitarian Landscape Collective, it's kind of like, it's more the word that people get instinctively about the kind of work you're trying to do.
Yes.
And it's just kind of catchy. Yeah, so there's humanitarian development work, and the difference is that humanitarian work is the kind of short-term, life-saving, immediate response.
The emergency relief,
yeah.
That kicks in when an emergency happens.
Which the irony is that landscape architects aren't really involved at that stage at all. So that's an irony.
It's a bit of a broken name. So development's more a bag, which is like the long-term resilience building.
Yep.
Like if you look at it in the terms of disaster, it's the kind of preparation of a place before you predict the disaster striking, and then it's the
recovery. It most deal with it? How can it best respond? Right.
Yeah. Mm. And then the sort of recovery after. So like the time scale is much longer, which is just, you know, like you said, it's like much more suited to our skills.
And I suppose we also target all the, you know, the global challenges about sustainable, unsustainable urbanization, mass displacement, climate change, and advocating for nature-based solutions to address those challenges. So despite training as a landscape architect, we have very little involvement in these areas.
Yeah. So having the skills to apply, not always.
Yeah, we're not always at the table.
No.
Making these decisions or even leading on these projects, because we're systems thinkers and we're really good at coordinating multidisciplinary teams. Yep. And these are complex events, single events or series of events that happen in people's lives.
Do you think that short-term fixes are often applied then to these situations rather than, that might not be nature-based?
We might get into a lot of trouble for saying this, but we think they're very reactionary.
Yep.
And if you go to refugee camps, for instance,
that's what I was thinking of.
I mean, their lifespan is about 25 years on average.
Not 2 years.
Not 2 years like they were intended.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of work to be done there.
So if you know it's going to be 25, or accept that it's going to be that long, plan for how you establish a community, basically, or a dwelling.
Yeah. I mean, it's so bad as to even these contexts where you plant a tree and they see that as a sign of permanence. Mm. So they eradicate any sign of vegetation.
Right.
But then they're there for 25 years without any shade.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a big political and financial background to all of this as well, which is stuff we're sort of just tapping into as the collective. So like, you know, there's the fact that a host country might not want refugees to be there for the long term because, you know, there's a kind of, you know, it takes resource to host them, and they might not have that resource. So which comes down to the tree thing, that, you know, they don't want a camp to be there in the long term. There's also financial, often some of the reasons why the short-term responses are some of the ones that use most commonly is also connected to funding. Like when there's a disaster, there's a big upsurge in funding for that thing.
Yep.
But then that kind of quickly tails off.
So there are certain things that you can apply that funding for quickly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it will only fund those activities.
Mm.
So there's like a trick to figuring out what you can do in the short term with that funding and like momentum that will lead to something long lasting.
Yep.
But I think that's like still being figured out even within like humanitarian development world. So I'm going to try and figure it out.
That's why we're here. So I guess what impact are you trying to make and for who?
Ultimately, it's to support people who are either affected by unsustainable urbanization, who have been displaced, who are like massive risk from climate change as well.
Yep.
But because we want to work at the practitioner level, and there's not really a likelihood of us as a group being directly involved with this project,
right.
We're going to try and help them indirectly.
Yes.
So
it's not a group of you're not organizing volunteers to go and specifically help with a camp. The idea is to have the resources for those to be used by the organizations effectively.
Yeah. So we're trying to create capacity building is one of them, and to help landscape architects realize that their skills are very much applicable in these contexts.
Yep.
I did a presentation to landscape architects and I asked the question, can you see your skill set being applied in these areas? And I just had blank looks.
Right.
So and I was like, we're so well placed.
Right. Okay, so it also goes back to your point earlier about that the people who know the problems they're facing best and will have a solution are those who are actually like living there and dealing with it day to day. So there's not like the reason we say we don't feel like we'll ever go into somewhere and like come up with a solution.
Top, yeah, it's not down solution.
Yeah, it's just not appropriate. And there's all sorts of problems with like professionals from the global north going into the global south, coming like saying, "Oh, here's what you should do."
Savior mentality. Yeah. Yes.
Which we think's just wrong.
Yep.
So like linking back to Joe's point, the better approach is to kind of like figure out a way in which the people living there have the skills that we've been trained with in order for them to come up with the solutions.
We just facilitate.
Yeah.
And there's people doing that already. So the way we think we can work indirectly is by kind of getting the skills and knowledge that we know into that capacity building work. And then that kind of like builds up their capacity to come up with their own solutions.
Yeah. Another link that we're actively involved in is outreach.
Right.
So we do connect to organizations where we see there can be a relationship that we can foster and funnel landscape architects towards them.
Right.
Yeah. So it's not like a void on the other side. We're trying to get both sides
together
in the conversation together. It's like a matchmaking service.
Yeah. But that's good. Everyone's happy then. So does that mean landscape architects would then be matched with a project?
Well, we don't know how that would work, but we definitely get them into the workshops.
Yeah.
So these organizations come along and they explain their issues on the ground.
Yeah.
And we could say, oh, you know, we've got these skills and brainstorm an idea.
Yeah.
And then perhaps people are interested to get involved in that way.
Yeah.
But we don't know this yet because we're still busy with our strategy this year.
Yeah, and you've done a lot of research as well. And I know a big focus in the last year has been the research element that you kind of, you're focused on research workshops and then publishing that research. And it's based around four key elements.
Yes.
I think you've done some, but not,
we've done half. Two of them.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the idea is really to advocate for architects working in the space to create this pathway.
Yep.
So this will lead towards a white paper by the end of the year where we devise this pathway. This is when we can start deciding how this relationship will work between landscape architects getting involved in the sector and strategically what is our place in creating that.
Yeah, and the four elements thing is, to go back to our friend Ellie, we decided to look at disasters as a research focus.
Yeah.
As you can imagine, we're trying to combine like landscape architecture and like all the problems in the world. There's like a lot of room for overlap.
Yeah. So it's
like,
it was
just like trying to tackle it once was just like way too broad. So we thought we'll start by just looking at disasters as a way to kind of like narrow our minds a bit.
Yep.
So the four elements thing was actually Ellie's idea. And it was that you could look at disasters through the four elements of earth, air, fire, and water. Mm-hmm. So we've done a workshop on water-related issues, which was looking at like the complexity of water within cities and then taking that into account when you're trying to build their resilience to like sea level rise and flooding and all the kind of big impacts as a result from climate change. Mm-hmm. Then we looked at fire. So for that, we teamed up with the fire team at Arup and looked at where the kind of overlaps are between landscape professionals and fire professionals.
Mm.
And that was all the way from the global scale down to like the building, household, or garden, something like that.
Right.
And then we're just starting earth.
Which is very apt, actually, with the earthquake happening in Turkey and Syria. It was the next one in line anyway, so it's a very hot topic at the moment. But
Highlights the real issues where, even though it was known it was coming, the complete displacement of a whole...
Of a whole generation.
Yeah.
So we're still figuring out, you know, the sort of strategy around that workshop.
Mm-hmm. So who would be at the workshop?
So it would be our landscape collective. So I don't think we mentioned this, but we're up to 200 members now. we had our 200th member sign up this week.
That's
so
amazing.
We're very excited. So and it's going to be online, virtual.
Yes.
So so this is amazing. This is a positive. So
up to 200 people joining.
Well, we doubt that would happen. It's across the globe. So I think time zone wise, it might be a bit tricky. But yeah, we still have to figure out like how the attendance
facilitate
the attendance, who to invite, especially key experts in earthquake seismic you know, engineering and design and perhaps affected communities if it's not sensitive and,
So affected communities, experts who might not be members of HLC and HLC members that can contribute.
Exactly.
And then your job is to facilitate, organize, publish.
So we kind of figured out the broad research question. And then next step is to then reach out to people who are active in that area. And then get them on board to come up with like the detailed research question, how to address it together.
So we collaborate with them.
Great. So you're framing the kind of the questions collaborative with them as well, not just setting the question, which might be the wrong question.
We really want to make it a fruitful session. So if we don't already know the obvious overlaps, we might spend too much time on the semantics.
Plus, if it's just like a group of landscape architects, then it ends up just being like this kind of echo chamber where you're not really digging into the problem or have like a real awareness of what it is. So it's like, it's a good way of just kind of like making sure that we're on point and on message with
stress testing our ideas.
That totally makes sense. And what then, so the expected outcome from the workshops is research and applicable strategies to be used in these four elements, and then also helping to define the strategy of HLC kind of going forwards for the future. Is that right?
Our ultimate goal was to figure out like a method by which landscape architects get more involved in this kind of work. And this, like the outcomes of these workshops and all the other kind of like workshops and conversations we have all builds into this white paper, which is like a kind of, it's like a summary of the problem, a summary of the research we've done into it, and then how to take it forward.
Yeah, it builds a case for us to get involved.
Wow.
And how.
Yeah. So what's then in 5 years, what would, it's difficult because you're still building that case, I guess.
Yeah, I feel like we could pivot at any point based on the research.
If it's the right pivot, then that's the right thing to do.
Healthy.
Yeah, it's healthy. So, but what would make you kind of in 5 or 10 years time feel kind of proud of what you've done?
I don't know. I've always felt like at a point where it's recognised by an organisation who is active in the affected context.
Yeah.
I think that's the point at which we feel like we've really like nailed it, just because like they're the ones who are going to be the ultimate like judge of how effective
you're off service to that group basically.
And if we've done all this work and at the end of the day like it's not made a jot of difference to one person who's actually facing the issues in informal settlement or they're being uprooted by climate change, then it's kind of like, what have we done it for? So that's that's the ultimate yardstick, I think.
So how can organisations or humanitarian causes get involved with your work? You've got a website.
Yes.
200 individual members, but you also work with a broad range of organisations and humanitarian causes. Mm. How do they find, you obviously go out and hunt them down. or get them involved.
That's exactly what we do.
Obviously you want to spread, you want more people, the right people to find you and organisations and humanitarian causes as well, because you're bringing people together. How does that happen? How can people find you?
I mean, the website's the first place.
It was so instrumental in getting more members. I mean, as soon as we launched, and we designed the website ourselves in our free time, but as soon as that went live, it really made a massive impact.
Right.
Yeah. So it's been up a year now. I think that's where most of our traffic comes from.
Right.
It's the website. And then we've also got social media platforms.
Yep.
We're not too active.
But people can find you. They can find us. Direct people to the website, which is kind of the main hub, I guess, right? And people sign up through the website?
Or they contact
you through the website to say, hey,
I want to get involved. Sign up form.
So they just
sign up and then we reach out. But I must say, we're relaunching this year.
Yeah.
So we've been around, I think this is our fifth year now, operating.
Yeah.
5 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
But this year was the real game changer because we hired, in inverted commas, about how many? 7 or 8 people to volunteer full time,
right.
3 hours a week or something.
Yep.
But we've got separate focuses within the group. So we've got a communication strategy coming along. It's going to help us with more visibility on social media.
Yep.
And then we also have a whole group of researchers, about 4 of them, that are focused on developing, you know, the workshop material and doing all the research behind and doing the outreach for collaborators. And then we have, we've got a social person who does in-person social get-togethers in London. So it's a little bit limited at the moment. But yeah, we do put these things in the calendar and hopefully, you know, can kind of link up with it, people living outside of London.
And would students ever contribute? Do students do dissertations as it started with Rhys on this topic as well and contribute, presumably?
We would love that.
Yeah, we could put it on the resource library. I mean, we have someone studying landscape architecture at the moment as one of the researchers.
Yes.
So I'm hoping she's able to like combine that with what we're doing as well.
Yeah.
But we're trying to get as many ideas and like current thinking on it as possible.
And if our members are happy, we love to publicize them on our website.
Yeah.
So we add their profile on our website so that they're more visible, that they are involved in this kind of work and what their specific areas of interest are.
Yeah. Can you see that this would ever be a part of a practice for landscape architecture, for an architecture practice? There would be a practice that focuses on...
We would love that.
Yeah.
But we don't know how to run a business.
Yeah.
We don't know how to monetize.
Right.
And it's a bit tricky to monetize in the sector
as
it is.
Yeah.
But if we could be sustainable, I think that's the main goal. I think this is, you know, our passion, both Rhys and I.
Yeah.
Yeah, it would be great to do it full time. I think, I don't know if that's realistic, but I kind of feel like where we might go is just consulting with practices or other built environment practices, and then, you know, NGOs as well, in order to make those links and facilitate them.
Yeah,
we could be part of like a social corporate responsibility program and see if that's like a model we could use.
And the most important thing is raising the visibility.
The awareness
and
is the most important thing, of course,
And so individuals can join as well. We'll have the website written down, I'm sure, but what is the website name, just so everyone has it now?
It's www.humanitarianlc.org, but if you just Google Humanitarian Landscape Collective, it should be the first one that comes up.
Lovely. Thank you. Thank you for coming in, and thank you for, I'm always in awe of people who have, you know, full-time jobs and, you know, all the other things that are going on with life, and to then also have this as a passion on top of everything else that's going on in your life, and to help other people. I think helping other people to find a way of contributing. Otherwise, as you say, you've got lots of individuals wishing they could do something and nothing actually happens. So it's amazing. Thank you. So I'm going to ask a couple of quick fire questions that we ask all the guests on the podcast, on the Green Room. So I'm going to start, Jo, with you.
Okay.
What made you want to be a landscape architect?
Well, like I said a little bit earlier, there's a bit of an accidental stumbling into the profession. It obviously would have been my first choice if I had more visibility of such a career. But I accidentally fell on into it, and it's honestly been the best accident that's happened in my life.
And so what is the one thing that landscape architects and the profession can do to help combat climate change?
I think the one takeaway would be to prioritize projects that are climate focused and socially just.
Yes.
If we're all doing a small part, then we're tackling all the areas of climate change.
Yeah. And collectively, it'll make more. Yeah. And then if you could put a bench in one spot in the world, where would it be?
I also found this a tricky question. I would put it back in Manica, my hometown in Mozambique. There's a beautiful ancient forest there. Yeah. It's pretty much untouched. It looks like Tarzan lives in there.
Yeah.
But it's in stark contrast to what's happening in the valley below.
Yep.
There's a lot of human activity, disrupting the landscape, open cast mining,
gold
panning, prevalence of plastic waste,
right.
things that I didn't grow up with.
Yeah.
So this bench would be a place to really reflect on what we could have, what we should preserve, what's important, and also, you know, tackling human activity that's a negative impact.
A reminder of human activity, the negative impact of human activity. Yeah,
precisely.
Reese, how about you? Where would you put a bench and why?
I know I'm supposed to come up with something quite profound, but I would also just go with my favourite place.
Yes, kind of absolutely.
Selfishly, I know, which is just the Fleet down in Dorset.
Yep.
Which is where I grew up. A nice sheltered spot.
Yep.
There.
And what is the one thing that landscape architects and the profession could do to help combat climate change?
I think about climate justice and think of that globally as well, because like often the people who are suffering the most from climate change are not those who are causing it, which we all know. And like as we're kind of figuring out through HOC, there's ways in which to adapt to those impacts which are outside the UK, and that's kind of often where it's needed most urgently, which just makes this seem like a real big plug for HLC.
Go but, for it.
But yeah, it's just to kind of think about where the actual impacts are and try and focus there.
And what made you want to be a landscape architect?
This is nowhere near as interesting as Joe's answer, like, you know, ancestral connection with the earth and moving to London to find it. But no, I just wanted to be an architect, did some work experience I thought was really dull, and then kind of thought that landscape was just a better like canvas to work with, because with a building you're really restrained, but I kind of felt like a landscape just more open, just a bit more free, kind of felt like from a design point of view it just be a bit more, I don't know, sort of prefer it.
Yes.
Doing this was never part of the equation when I first got into it, and it's kind of just happened over time. But yeah, it was just like a design thing.
I'm curious to know how landscape architecture got into your periphery during, you know, your childhood, or was it
school? One of the bits of work experience was at a council back down in Dorset. It was with architects, and there was only one landscape architect there, and I kind of was having like a crisis about architecture, then just remembered this lady and was like, I wonder what they do, looked into it, and then just kind of thought the things that were listed on the website just sounded like a lot more that kind of thing I wanted to do. So it was just by chance meeting this person. I don't know if it would have happened otherwise. I think it's the same for a lot of people.
Interesting. Aren't there's still fortunate. Things I don't know about.
Yeah. Yeah. After 5 years.
After 5 years, you still fascinate me.
Oh, well, thank you both. Well, first of all, for coming in, but secondly, more importantly, for doing what you're doing. Because I think on lots of these big questions, it takes people who really put their time, effort and passion into something for it to actually move forward. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for giving us a voice.